name is Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Faith Perlow brings us a story on the flooding in Pakistan. Anna Mateo presents this week's health and lifestyle report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, a report on Queen Elizabeth II's state funeral.
Britain and the world said a final goodbye to Queen Elizabeth II at her state funeral Monday. Presidents, prime ministers, kings, and princes came to honor her 70 years in power. It was Britain's first state funeral since Winston Churchill's in 1965. Before the service, a bell rang 96 times, once a minute for each year of Elizabeth's life. Then 142 Royal Navy sailors pulled the gun carriage with her coffin to London's Westminster Abbey, where around 2,000 people gathered for the ceremony. The coffin was covered with the royal flag. Atop it sat the imperial state crown with almost 3,000 diamonds, along with the royal orb and scepter. Her son, King Charles III, and other members of the royal family followed the coffin into the church. David Hoyle is the head clergyman of Westminster Abbey. As the funeral opened, he said, "Here, where Queen Elizabeth was married and crowned, we gather from across the nation, from the Commonwealth, and from the nations of the world, to mourn our loss, to remember her long life of selfless service." The service ended with 2 minutes of silence observed across Britain, and the attendees sang, "God Save the King." The day began early when the doors of the British Parliament closed to mourners. Many had waited for hours in line to walk by her coffin lying in state. Hundreds of thousands lined the sidewalks of central London to watch the coffin travel through the city after the service. Others went to parks and public spaces across Britain to watch the funeral on large screens. Millions more watched live television broadcasts around the world. After the passage through central London, the coffin headed for Windsor Castle, where Elizabeth was buried in a private ceremony in St. George's Chapel. Tracy Dobson was among the last people to join the line in London. "I felt like I had to come and pay my final respects to our majestic queen," she said. "She has done so much for us, and just a little thank you, really, from the people." Gilly Fitzgerald was in Windsor. She said there was a feeling of community among the mourners as they prepared to wait hours to see the Queen's coffin. "It's good to be with all the people who are feeling the same. It's like a big family, because everyone feels that the Queen was part of their family," she said. U.S. President Joe Biden, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Japan's Emperor Naruhito were among the world leaders at the ceremony. Others included all living former British prime ministers, as well as European royalty. On the evening before the funeral, King Charles III sent a message of thanks to people in Britain and around the world. He said he and his wife Camilla have been moved beyond measure by the large numbers of people who are mourning the Queen. Elizabeth was the 40th monarch in a family line that dates its history back to 1066. She came to power in 1952 and became Britain's first monarch after the end of the British Empire. She oversaw her nation trying to build a new place in the world. She was very important in helping create the Commonwealth of Nations, now a grouping of 56 countries.
Severe flooding in Pakistan has left tens of thousands of people sick with infectious and waterborne diseases. Women and children in rural areas are especially vulnerable to such diseases, experts say. Floodwaters have begun to recede or move away, but water may remain in places for 2 to 6 months. Stagnant water presents a serious risk to people living in the affected areas. Stagnant means water that is not flowing. Diseases such as malaria, dengue fever, and skin problems are spreading quickly. That information comes from a new report by the government of Pakistan's southern Sindh province. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif recently spoke at a Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, meeting in Uzbekistan. He said stagnant water is giving rise to the waterborne diseases. Children getting malaria and diarrhea, all kinds of diseases. Millions of people are living under open sky. The floods have forced hundreds of thousands of people from their homes. Those people are now in desperate need of food, shelter, clean drinking water, toilets, and medicine. The flooding has affected 33 million people, 16 million of which are children. Over 3 million of those children need immediate life-saving support, the United Nations Refugee Agency says. Since July 1st, temporary medical centers set up in the flooded region have treated 2.3 million people. There have been 1,508 deaths so far, including 536 children and 308 women. According to Pakistan's National Disaster Management Authority, Abdullah Fadil is a United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, representative in Pakistan. He said in a statement, "I have been in the flood-affected areas for the past 2 days. The situation for families is beyond bleak, and the stories I heard paint a desperate picture." Fadil confirmed that he had seen malnourished children and mothers with the diseases like diarrhea and malaria. The flooding is considered a once-in-a-century event. It was likely made more severe by climate change, scientists said last week. Extreme seasonal rains in the southern areas of Pakistan, combined with glacial melt caused by climate change in the northern areas, created the massive flooding. Pakistan's monsoon season this year started earlier than usual and ended later than usual. The country received 391 millimeters of rain during the monsoon period. That is 190% more than the 30-year average. I'm Faith Perlow.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. When it comes to making lunch for their kids, moms and dads have usual favorites. For some parents in the United States, those favorites are peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, also known as PB&Js. Fruit, like apples and bananas, are also popular. But one mother has an unusual go-to ingredient for her children's lunches. Jenny Mullen uses funny-looking candy eyes. She has learned that her children will eat any healthy food if it has edible eyeballs attached. The eyeballs are really pieces of candy. Her children laugh while they eat healthy foods like bell peppers, kiwis, or dates. The writer and actor says the candy eyes make lunch more fun. She wrote about her creative school lunches in a book, Dictator Lunches, Inspired Meals That Will Compel Even the Toughest of Children. Honestly, first of all, just buy yourself some candy googly eyes. They are tried and true, she said. She admits that you lose something nutritionally by giving children candy, but she thinks that getting children to eat healthy food by putting candy on it is worth it. Mullen's lunch tricks bring together food and craft. She uses tricks because her two sons do not like to eat different kinds of foods. So she decorates their food to look like animals, or even their favorite Pokemon characters. She makes edible bugs made from dates, pretzel sticks for the legs, and of course, candy eyes. She also uses leftover Chinese food to make panda bears from rice and seaweed. Mullen notes that she puts yogurt into fruit, like strawberries and raspberries, and then tops with some granola, a mixture of oats and nuts. She says her lunch projects are easy to do, and her sons think they have won a big prize at their midday meal. The edible art is not hard to make. To create it, she says you only need a few tools: a vegetable peeler, shaped containers and cutters, and some special knives. She says she does not have to buy special ingredients. She uses leftovers from dinner the night before and everyday items from her food storage area. She likes using sunflower seed butter to stick her creations together. This idea of making food fun-looking is not new. Some Japanese parents are known for creating artful lunches, called bento boxes. They often have cute animal-shaped rice balls and flowers, or other shapes, made from vegetables. Mullen says making fun-looking, artful lunches for her children helps to ease her guilt. She says, "I am a working mom, and not the mom doing pickup and drop-off. I'm not with them at the park after school every day. I am usually working." Her artful lunches are her way of reminding her children that she is thinking of them. Mullen says she also wants to teach them healthy eating habits. She says that by getting kids to eat vegetables at a young age, they will grow up to eat healthy foods later in life. She also says it is a good way to get children to try foods from other cultures. If they need to be tricked sometimes, that is okay. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
VOA Learning English. This is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we complete the story of the American Revolution. The time is December 1776. British General William Howe has decided to stop fighting during the cold winter months. The general is in New York. He has already established control of a few areas near the city, including Trenton and Princeton in New Jersey. General George Washington and the Continental Army are on the other side of the Delaware River. The Americans are cold and hungry. They have few weapons. Washington knows that if Howe attacks, the British will be able to go all the way to Philadelphia.
He's looking at his army, which is melting away.
Historian Gordon Wood says that moment was the low point of the war for George Washington.
And he decides to make one great effort on Christmas night and crosses the Delaware, dead of winter, cold, ice, and he crosses and attacks Trenton, where you have about 1,000 Hessians who are kind of overwhelmed and defeated. It's a small tactical victory, but a great psychological effect, because it's the first time that Washington had actually done something positive, and it really does, I think, change the psychology of the war.
Another result of the victory at Trenton was that more men decided to join the army. It now had 10,000 soldiers. This new Continental Army, however, lost battles during the summer to General Howe's forces near the Chesapeake Bay. And in August 1777, General Howe captured Philadelphia. Following these losses, Washington led the army to the nearby area of Pennsylvania called Valley Forge.
Valley Forge was the camp where George Washington and his army spent a really miserable, miserable winter.
Alice Camps is a curator at the National Archives in Washington, where some of the country's most important documents are kept. One of those documents is a letter that George Washington wrote from Valley Forge.
And the men had nothing to wear. They had no blankets. They had very little to eat. Illnesses were rampant. It was a very, very miserable experience for them.
But in the middle of that winter, Washington finds out that France has decided to sign a treaty with the colonists.
News. This is the kind of news that would make anyone just run about screaming with joy and doing handstands. But Washington is so reserved, and he says that he's received this news with, quote, the most sensible pleasure, unquote.
He also says he is going to wait for the government to approve the treaty before he tells the army.
The fact that he is not going to announce this news immediately to his army speaks to the fact that he was always, always concerned with doing the right thing and with protocol.
By the spring of 1778, General Washington and his army were ready to fight again. General Howe was still in Philadelphia. His behavior as a military leader was sometimes difficult to understand. At times, he was a good commander and a brave soldier. At other times, he stayed in the safety of cities instead of leading his men in battle. The next series of important battles in the American Revolution was led by another British general, John Burgoyne. His plan was to capture the Hudson River Valley in New York State and separate New England from the other colonies. Doing this, the British believed, would make it easier to capture the other colonies. The plan did not succeed. American General Benedict Arnold defeated the British troops in New York. General Burgoyne had expected help from General Howe, but that help never came. Burgoyne was forced to surrender at the town of Saratoga. The American victory at Saratoga was extremely important. It ended the British plan to separate New England from the other colonies. It also showed European nations that the Americans might be able to win their revolution. This was something that France especially had wanted ever since being defeated earlier by the British in the French and Indian War. The French government had been supplying the Americans secretly through the work of America's minister to France, Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was popular with the French people and with French government officials. He helped gain French sympathy for the American cause. After the American victory at Saratoga, the French decided to enter the war on the American side. The two nations signed military and political treaties. Historian Gordon Wood says this alliance created bigger problems for the British.
Because once the French were involved, it turns the thing from counterinsurgency for the British. They're now fighting a world war.
The British immediately sent a message to America's Continental Congress. They offered to go back to a time of better relations. the Americans rejected the British offer. The war would be fought to the end. In 1779, Spain entered the war against the British. And the next year, the British were also fighting the Dutch to stop their trade with America. The French now sent gunpowder, soldiers, officers, and ships to the Americans. However, neither the Americans nor the British made much progress in the war for the next 2 years. By 1780, the British had moved their military forces to the American South. They quickly gained control of South Carolina and Georgia. But the Americans prevented them from taking control of North Carolina. After that, the British commander moved his troops to Yorktown, Virginia. The commander's name was Lord Charles Cornwallis. Both he and George Washington had about 8,000 troops when they met near Yorktown. Cornwallis was expecting more troops to arrive on British ships. What he did not know was that French ships were on their way to Yorktown, too. Their commander was Admiral François Comte de Grasse. De Grasse met some of the British ships that Cornwallis was expecting and defeated them. The French ships then moved into the Chesapeake Bay near Yorktown. The Americans and the French began attacking the British with cannons. Then they fought the British soldiers hand to hand. Cornwallis knew he had no chance to win without more troops. He surrendered to George Washington on October 17, 1781. The war was over. American and French forces had captured or killed half of the British troops in America. The surviving troops left Yorktown playing a popular British song called "The World Turned Upside Down." How were the Americans able to defeat the most powerful nation in the world? Historians give several reasons. The Americans were fighting at home, while the British had to bring troops and supplies from across the ocean. British officers made mistakes, especially General William Howe. His slowness to take action at the start of the war made it possible for the Americans to survive two difficult winters. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says the British also thought more colonists would support them.
When Burgoyne comes down the Hudson Valley, he starts out with an army of 10,000 or so, and he has to hack his way through the woods, and he keeps losing troops to small militia. He counted on more loyalist support than there was, and I think the British miscalculated terribly on that point.
Another reason the Americans won was the help they received from the French. Also, the British public had stopped supporting the long and costly war. Finally, America might not have won without the leadership of George Washington. He never gave up hope.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.